across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Hello, it's Holly here, in for Stephen for the next couple of days. And today we had reaction to the government's decision to grant a public inquiry into the murder of the Belfast solicitor, Pat Finucane. It has been welcomed, of course, by the family and by campaigners, while some unionist politicians are arguing that it's creating almost a hierarchy of victims here. So we heard from a former Secretary of State and from the UUP's Doug Beattie on that. We also talked about the brand new, sparkly, shiny Grand Central Station, which does seem to be suffering with a few teething problems, mainly around issues to do with accessibility. We have been assured fixes and solutions are in the pipeline. The question is, what about those with disabilities in the meantime who need to use the service right now? And we talked about the streets in Belfast with just two households. One in support of a new bilingual street sign, the other household voted against it, and due to how it works, the street has a new Irish street sign put in. Has it become counterproductive to do it street by street on this basis, or is it the only fair way to ensure that more voices are being heard on this issue? As always, have your say. It's nolan at bbc.co.uk. We're back tomorrow at 9. I'll see you then. The Stephen Nolan Show! Hello, good morning. How are we all doing? It's Holly Hamilton here in for Stephen. Thursday, 12th of September, and as always, a busy one today. We will, of course, be looking at Northern Ireland's First and Deputy First Minister's trip off to London to meet the Chancellor. What's on your wish list? What would you like them to be talking about? We'll also be looking at the prisoner release programme that's taken place in England and Wales. Should early release be brought in over here? And disagreements with your neighbours. How does that go? Yeah, after two houses, only two houses in the same street, one house voted in favour of Irish street signs and the other voted against it. I don't want to be there when the bins go out. Awkward. 0 30 30 80 55 55. I'd love to hear from you on all of our stories today. We are, of course, starting with the news that you heard in the headlines. The Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, facing questions this morning over his proposals to deal with the legacy of the Troubles after announcing the establishment of an independent inquiry into the murder of Belfast solicitor Pat Finucane. The 39-year-old was shot by loyalist paramilitaries at his home in 1989 in front of his wife and children.
Three men smashed down the front door of the Finucane home in the suburban Fort William area of North Belfast at about 7:30. They chased Mr. Finucane into the kitchen, and it's believed one of them shot him several times from close range. He died almost at once. His wife was also shot and injured in the leg.
How many shots did you hear?
About 6 or 7.
And what happened after that then?
Just heard there was a bit of a pause and then a car gone off quite fast.
Mr. Finucane was well known as a practising solicitor. He'd been involved in many terrorist cases, and at a recent inquest he'd represented the family of an IRA man shot dead by police in 1982. He was also involved in the defence of some of those charged over the murder of two British Army corporals in Andersonstown last year.
Well, previous examinations of the case have found evidence of state collusion in the killing, but the Finucane family say the full extent of that collusion has never been established. A Court of Appeal ruling set a deadline of the 27th of September for the UK government to announce whether or not a public inquiry would be held. So here is the moment the Northern Ireland Secretary, Hilary Benn, made the announcement in the House of Commons yesterday.
This government takes its human rights obligations and its responsibilities to victims and survivors of the Troubles extremely seriously. And the plain fact is that two decades on, the commitment made by the government, first in the agreement with the Irish government and then to this House, to establish an inquiry into the death of Mr. Finucane remains unfulfilled. It is for this exceptional reason that I have decided to establish an independent inquiry into the death of Patrick Finucane under the 2005 Inquiries Act.
Well, Pat Finucane's wife, Geraldine, who was also wounded in the attack, gave this reaction yesterday afternoon.
Most of all, I believe this inquiry can be a watershed moment in the difficult subject of legacy in this part of our island. If a public inquiry into the murder of Pat Finucane can finally public examine all of the collusion that plagued our society for so many years, then there is hope that the real process of healing can begin. The murder of Pat Finucane is the last remaining Weston Park case. It is high time it was properly investigated, publicly examined, and finally resolved. I believe that my family deserve this after so many years. Pat Finucane deserves this after so many years. Society as a whole deserves this after so many years. And after 35 years of cover-ups, it is time for truth.
Now, Pat Finucane's son, John Finucane, who is also the Sinn Féin MP for North Belfast, responded to the suggestion by some that his family was given preferential treatment.
Every single bit of progress we've had as a family has had to be fought for. It's never been handed to us. We've had to fight in courts, domestic and international. My mother has not only had to deal with being a widow and raising three young children, but she's had to travel the world to gain support, which we were lucky enough to have. And every single bit of progress over a painful 35 and a half years has been hard fought. And I would be very slow to describe that as preferential treatment.
Well, this inquiry has divided opinion along party political lines. It has been welcomed by Sinn Féin, the SDLP and the Alliance Party. It's been criticised by the DUP, UUP and TUV, who say it creates a hierarchy of victims. And some victims are asking this morning, what about them, as concerns remain over the government's proposals to deal with the legacy of the past? Will this be the last public inquiry into a Troubles-related killing? And where does this leave the role of the legacy body? The Reconciliation and Information Recovery, led by former Lord Chief Justice Sir Declan Morgan. Well, let's speak to Julian O'Neill, who's the BBC's Crime and Justice correspondent. Morning, Julian.
Good morning, Holly.
It was interesting listening to Geraldine Finucane, and she has described this as a long journey. She was very emotional yesterday. And this is, of course, a journey that you have followed so closely. Just remind us of the background to this, and I suppose the significance of this independent public inquiry.
This has been a case which has never been far from the headlines for 35 years. It's been in and out of the news almost constantly over that period of time. It has become one of the most notorious murders of the Troubles, and there were 3,500 deaths in the Troubles, remember. And it has become arguably the most significant and high-profile murder case involving collusion. There has been a drip-drip of revelation over the years, which has revealed collusion in this killing. Police and army agents were involved in the UDA murder plot. MI5 was aware of the threat Mr. Finucane was under, but previous examinations have never found an overarching state conspiracy in his killing. Now, the family, I think, would challenge that. They believe that the collusion went as far as cabinet level, and one imagines that it is their hope and expectation that this public inquiry would examine the scale of collusion involved in this murder. There have been a number of examinations, as you say, but they have been hobbled to various degrees, an inability to call witnesses, witnesses not cross-examined, material not handed over by the state. The terms of reference of this public inquiry will be published in due course, and we'll know exactly what will be examined. But it is the end of a long 35-year journey for the Finucane family.
Yeah, as you mentioned there, there have been, of course, previous investigations, one of which led to David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, apologising to the family on behalf of the British government. Within all these investigations, and you've alluded to it there, it's sort of the extent of collusion. But what would the family be hoping to get out of this? What's the end result? What truths are left to discover?
I think the family need to be satisfied that there is absolute full disclosure in this case, and there hasn't been thus far. They are armed, remember, with a ruling from the highest court in the UK, the Supreme Court, which in 2019 found that there had never been a proper, adequate investigation into Pat Finucane's murder. That's one of that ruling makes this which makes it probably a unique case, and is probably part of the basis upon which the Secretary of State has agreed to a public inquiry. So there has never been an adequate investigation. They have always felt that a public inquiry was required to shine a full spotlight on what happened, and they will be examining the terms of reference of the inquiry closely. But it is their expectation that this judge-led public inquiry, whenever it begins and however long it takes, will uncover the full truth of what went on.
We did hear from the Shadow Secretary of State, Alex Bowcart, on Good Morning Ulster this morning. He stated this public inquiry is exactly the same as the one the Finucane family were offered previously when they rejected the offer. Is that a fair assessment?
There have been two promises made previously by a Labour government in 2001 and 2004 to establish a public inquiry into the murder of Pat Finucane. Now, in the mid-2000s, there were discussions between the Finucane family and the British government to establish a public inquiry under the 2005 Inquiries Act, which is the piece of legislation which is being used to establish this inquiry. But the government and the Finucanes were unable to reach an agreement on the arrangements for a public inquiry at that point in time. John Finucane was asked about this at the press conference yesterday, and he said that a difficulty arose when the government at that time made it clear that they intended to use part of that legislation to have rendered, in his words, an inquiry meaningless. Now, the implication is that while the same piece of legislation will be used to establish this public inquiry, the implication is that this government will not, like previous governments, attempt to limit or impede the inquiry. So I think the Finucanes view this offer from the Secretary of State as being one made in good faith, whereas perhaps previously they felt the offer of a public inquiry wouldn't satisfy their demands.
It's been a mixed reaction to this, you know, talk, particularly from unionist politicians, of a hierarchy of victims. I suppose the question then is, where does this leave other victims and the families of victims, who some are hoping this might lead to further public inquiries, others agree that this is preferential treatment? What does this have the potential to what impact could this have on those victims?
There's no doubt in my view that this government was dragged to a position of having to establish a public inquiry based on previous commitments and based on court rulings. The timing, though, I think could be seen as being hugely inconvenient for the government, because at the same time it has established this public inquiry, it is in the business of encouraging all other bereaved families of the Troubles to deal with a new independent commission set up to deal with all legacy cases. So outside that independent commission for reconciliation and information recovery is the case of Pat Finucane, which is going to have a public inquiry. Now, Hilary Benn made clear yesterday that he did consider sending the Pat Finucane case to the new commission, but ultimately decided that there were exceptional and unique circumstances in the Pat Finucane case, largely commitments made previously to hold a public inquiry, which he felt had to be honoured. But you're right, everyone else will be asked to deal with this new commission, and there continues to be a debate around whether the commission is fit for purpose and whether it has the necessary powers to deliver for families. Now, Hilary Benn said yesterday that the new commission has powers equivalent to the Inquiries Act. And I think he was signalling that everybody else who will seek a public inquiry, and there have been many calls from many other bereaved families for public inquiries, he believes that the direction that they should head in is towards this independent commission. And we should remember that only the government has the power to establish a public inquiry. So it controls who gets a public inquiry and who doesn't. And it looked to me, when the announcement was made yesterday, that Hilary Benn was saying The Finucane case is exceptional. Everyone else will go to the commission. And I think there's perhaps only one caveat to that. And it might be that if other families embark on the same type of legal action that the Finucanes have been engaged in for decades and ultimately drag a government to a position where it has to establish a public inquiry in their case as well.
Do you think that this is kind of, and we were talking about this earlier in the week, that the fact that this, you know, the Independent Commission for Reconciliation and Information Recovery, the ICRIR, is there a question mark over that? You know, when we look at the fact that it's only, what, 8 cases in its first 4 months, the effectiveness, and just for those families who have been told that this is where they have to go?
I think it is beginning operations at a difficult moment in time. It was created by the last government under a hugely divisive and controversial Legacy Act. Now, this government has pledged to replace that Legacy Act with an act of its own. But it has also made clear that it feels that the commission will remain in place. So I think the commission is struggling, I think, to gain traction and support, largely, I think, in part due to it has been contaminated by the last government's Legacy Act. But it's clear that Hilary Benn wants to stick with it, but he has suggested that there will be significant changes to its powers. So I think Labour will hope to reshape the commission, and in that process, make it more appealing to victims' families, victims' organisations and political parties. But at this moment in time, it is a body which is struggling to gain support, and I think that is reflected in its caseload.
Gillian O'Neill, thank you. Let's speak to Doug Beattie of the Ulster Unionist Party, their justice spokesperson. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Holly.
Sean Woodward is on the line, the former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland from 2007 to 2010. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Doug, first of all, just to lay out how you feel about this, you know, considering the Secretary of State has described this as exceptional. It's an exceptional case, the reasoning being the outstanding and unfulfilled commitments by previous UK governments to establish a public inquiry means that it should proceed. Do you agree that this is an exceptional case?
Well, listen, Ollie, let's baseline all of this, first of all, and that is murder, and Pat Finucane was murdered. And there are people out there who are victim-blaming somebody who has been murdered. Now, I spent the last number of weeks arguing with people who tried to victim-blame Robert Narak, who was kidnapped, tortured and murdered, saying that he was a legitimate target or that he deserved what he got. That was wrong. And this is wrong. So murder is murder, and the family of Pat Finucane deserve truth and justice and accountability where that is possible. But there is genuine anger, and that genuine anger is that there are many families out there who have got nothing from this process. My own uncle, Samuel Johnson, murdered in April 1975, not far from where I'm sitting now. Nobody has been arrested. There's been no follow-up investigation. Certainly no inquiry. The Birmingham pub bombing, who have been campaigning for an awful long time, no public inquiry. And I would also argue the case about the Ballygawley bus bombing in 1988. 8 dead soldiers in a soft-skinned bus driving up a road where the security forces knew there may have been a device, and there's no inquiry into that. And the last one I would say is, why is there no inquiry into Sinn Féin, who refused to engage with the King's Mill inquest, therefore denying justice to the family? And of course, the Ireland itself, who have done absolutely nothing on legacy. So I take nothing away from Pat Finucane's family as a search for truth and justice and accountability. But I do argue the case for all of those other people who have been absolutely ignored by this government and successive governments over this last number of years.
In all the cases that you've just mentioned, will you be calling for a public inquiry into those cases?
And have done on many occasions. I've written to
numerous... Have you spoken to Hilary Benn?
Well, not yet, no, but I spoke to his predecessor and I spoke to those that came before. I've done this on many occasions. I've written to the previous Secretary of State in regards to the King's Mill inquest and why Sinn Féin refused to give evidence at that. And I think we need to look into that. I have a belief, Holly, and this is a personal belief, that we do, and quite rightly, go after the guys who pulled the trigger or planted the bomb. But we seem to forget about those who are at the very top, who sent them out to pull that trigger and plant the bomb. And I think we need a public inquiry into that. And that means a public inquiry into those who lead our government here in Northern Ireland, who were part of that mechanism, who murdered so many of our people, including my uncle Samuel. Because his name doesn't trip off anybody's tongue. Yet he is a victim exactly the same way as Pat Finucane is a victim. And I think, you know, the Secretary of State and this UK government need to realign itself a little bit.
Is that the difference? The difference, you say, is it's not tripping off the tongue of anyone here. But you've said yourself this is not a conversation that you have had yet with Hilary Benn, but the Finucane Centre, the Finucane family have.
No, and this is why I said to you at the very start, to baseline all of this, I take nothing away from the Finucane family in their quest for justice. I've said that, I'll say it again, they deserve truth, justice and accountability, and nobody can argue in regards to that. And I've said that to John Finucane to his face, and he knows that as well. You're absolutely right. But if you don't get somebody understanding what it's like to be a victim, and I'm not talking about myself, I'm not a victim, I'm talking about the many victims who are out there. And look, the Birmingham pub bombings, victims, 21 dead, more than 200 injured, have been arguing again with successive governments for an inquest, an inquiry, and they've received absolutely nothing. But my real concern is how a political party who runs this country, who's part of the governmental mechanisms of the United Kingdom, Sinn Féin, can refuse to give information to an inquest, who can be part of an organisation, the IRA, who murdered so many of our people here in Northern Ireland, further afield.
But could this instigate more? I mean, I suppose where we take this now, is this the start of more public inquiries, or is this the end of it? How do you see it?
Well, I think that there's an argument to be made for I mean, you can't do public inquiries with all of them. You're absolutely right. And the ICRIR is a mechanism that we've been told that everybody has to use. And that's right. But there are some where I think there's huge public interest. Sorry, say again.
Do you think it's effective, the ICRIR?
The ICRIR?
Mm-hmm.
I've no idea. Holly, it's only just really started. It's really just kicking off. I've got absolute trust in those people who are running the ICRIR, but I will not know how effective it'll be for quite some time now. So it needs support, and I will give it the support, but I can't tell you whether it'll be effective or whether it won't be effective for a while yet. So we need to watch this space in many ways.
How will you judge that?
Well, we'll judge it by the victims who have gone forward to the ICRIR to see if they have got what they require from it. So it won't be judged by me as a politician. It will be judged by the victims.
Sean Woodward, listening to that. I mean, Doug isn't alone. We've got quite a few texts coming in here. There's a lot of, what about this victim? What about this family? What about this instance? And I suppose my question to you is, what about them?
The most important thing to register here is that the government gave a commitment in 2001 and 2004 that there would be a full public inquiry. When I was Secretary of State, I met with the Finucane family. I believed it was the right thing to do. In 2011, the new government under David Cameron and Owen Paterson reneged on that commitment. We then had Desmond De Silva's review, and in 2012, I made it very clear, although clearly no longer Secretary of State, the Conservative Party were now in government, that there should be a full public inquiry because of the issues raised about collusion with the security forces. It was unequivocal in my mind. We made the commitment in 2001. We renewed it in 2004. It was very clear to me that David Cameron made a very big error of judgment in not going through with that. And then the attempt was made to not have it at all. So I welcome Hilary Benn's announcement, not because we're starting something new here. We are actually completing something we promised to do. And as part of the peace process, those commitments are really important as confidence-building measures. So it's fulfilling a commitment, not making a new one.
Trying to read between the lines here, and you know, obviously I can't speak for victims, but certainly there are some victims and some families who won't want public inquiries. Do you think that there is a different way of dealing with this? Maybe the idea of separating out those who, for example, where there is collusion to other cases. So prioritise those that should go to the ICRIR and those that should have a public inquiry.
Well, these are issues that the new Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, has got to consider. What I think has changed, which is so welcome, is that once again we have a government who thinks that dealing with the issues related to the past, the so-called legacy issues, and when we call it that, let's remember we're talking about murders that took place of loved ones on all sides of the communities. It really does matter that we fulfill our commitments as part of the peace process. And what I welcome is that we now have a government with Keir Starmer as Prime Minister who really believes that Northern Ireland matters and has made it very clear that actually ensuring the politics of Northern Ireland going forwards functions is a very important part of his job as Prime Minister of the UK. That's a huge difference on the past government, where we had Prime Ministers like Boris Johnson who barely knew where Belfast was.
Take me back to whenever you were Secretary of State. What was the reasoning for not having a public inquiry at that point?
Well, you'll remember at the time we had a number of public inquiries going, and we were about to have the announcement that would come out of the Savile inquiry. It had gone on for several years, and that was a matter of concern. We had under the 2005 legislation, the Inquiries Act, new ways of going forward, and we were trying to reach agreement on how we would do it. But it was unequivocal that we should have it. I was on the record through my time as saying we should have it. In 2011, when, again, bizarrely, David Cameron invited the Finucan family to Downing Street in order to tell them he wasn't going to be having the inquiry we had promised to have. That was a terrible error of judgment by David Cameron and Owen Paterson at the time. And the 2012 announcement that came out of the De Silva review, as I said at the time to the BBC and at the Labour Party conference, nothing demonstrated why this inquiry was more important than actually the outcome of the De Silva review. And I think this is a confidence-building measure now. We promised to do it, it is right to do it, and it is finally something which I think will speak well beyond the Finucane family, although for the Finucane family, of course, it's very important that this happens. But Hilary Benn has also got to decide how to deal with these other very important legacy issues. This is not a hierarchy of murders that's being investigated here. This is a solemn commitment by the UK government, which sadly the Conservative government, for some bizarre reason, decided they weren't going to have, even though we had committed to doing so.
You can understand why people are critical and talking about a hierarchy when we look at the resources that have gone into this previously, into Mr. Finucane's death, you know, the Stevens report, the Corey report, De Silva report, which obviously all find evidence of collusion, state collusion. Do you know of more evidence? Do you know something in your conversations that you've had that there is more to be uncovered?
I know that it is important that we have a transparent process where everything that could be known is now put into the public arena. And it's that commitment we made in 2001, renewed in 2004, that for reasons better known to himself, David Cameron reneged on in 2011 and 2012.
Why do you think?
I don't know. I find it utterly bizarre. And I've always regarded the job of Northern Ireland Secretary as above party politics. You know, we are the guardians and safekeepers, along with the government in Dublin, of the Good Friday Agreement, a peace process which is extremely important for everybody in Northern Ireland, regardless of their community. And it baffled me why the government at the time, under David Cameron, reneged on a very solemn commitment. I believe you don't mess around with the foundations of the peace process. If you do, it causes trouble. I'm very pleased to see that Hilary Benn and Keir Starmer have decided that actually it's important to fulfil the commitment we gave.
Well, I'm sure that an inquiry will explore in further detail some of the issues that we're discussing here, but, you know, that there was a suggestion that collusion went right up to cabinet level. Do you agree?
I have no idea whether collusion went right up to cabinet level. What I do know is that it's very clear from everything we've heard and seen, not least De Silva's review itself, that actually there is a need for a transparent process to look at all of these matters.
In terms of the ICRIR, there was sort of a suggestion from Hilary Benn that it will be retained, but perhaps there will be changes. What do you make of how effective it's been and will continue to be?
Well, I think what Hilary is showing is a commitment to get on with the importance of trying to understand the past and put it into the context of how we build a more stable future in Northern Ireland. So what the Secretary of State is rightly doing in his job now is not saying this is the Labour Party's position. He is saying, let's look at what we need to do in Northern Ireland to get stability back into the politics and to ensure that the peace process continues to function as it was designed. And part of that is dealing with the past. And I'm confident that Hilary, who is a very, very considerable figure, great intellect, great mind, a compassionate person, is now going to actually apply those qualities to dealing with these very sensitive issues. They are sensitive. They go well beyond a particular community. They are about the value of life and death and how we expect the state to protect us. And it's very, very important that Hilary takes that side of the job seriously. It hasn't been taken seriously enough in the last 14 years, unfortunately. But once again, we're now picking up the reins of responsibility for people in Northern Ireland, regardless of community. And I have every confidence that Hilary will deliver on that.
Doug Beattie, do you agree with that? The idea that these issues have not been taken seriously enough in the past? And what impact do you think this decision will have on politics here?
Well, look, I don't know what the impact will have on politics going forward. We need to have a look at that. There needs to be a degree of trust, and trust does get eroded sometimes when decisions like this are made, where one side of the community feels that they are being frozen out of certain things. Have we taken this seriously enough over the years? And I've gone on record to say that we haven't. We've kind of ignored it. We've kind of danced around it. We haven't taken those difficult decisions and gone ahead with them. If you remember back to 2006, those public inquiries, it was for Rosemary Nelson, Mark Hamill, Billy Wright, and the Irish did one for Superintendent Buchanan and Breen, who were murdered with collusion from the Garda and the Irish government. Pat Finucane was offered an inquiry then and said no. In fact, Amnesty International led a boycott of the Public Inquiries Act 2005 way back then, and maybe they need to come on and answer some questions in that. But what I'm trying to make here is not take away from the Finucane family, who deserve, and I've said this many times, truth, justice and accountability. But I want to argue the case for those others who aren't getting it, and that's why I mentioned, and there's many more to mention, by the way, and sorry I can't mention them all, but Birmingham and Ballygawley, my own family, and certainly the Kingsmill inquest, which I sat in, when we had those who lead our government refusing to give evidence in it. And then we have the Irish government, who have done pretty much zero in regards to legacy. And if there's ever going to be a case of having to do public inquiries...
How do you plan to move this forward then, Doug?
Well, look, I can only do what I can do with my party. I know that our MP in Westminster and Tom Elliott in the Lords and our MLA group will lobby the Secretary of State and the government in regards to this, because we do need to look at some of these other big issues, because until they're dealt with, there will be one side of this community who will feel that it's been frozen out of the process, where the ICRIR is good enough for them, but not good enough for anybody else. And that is a genuine concern, and it will erode trust in some cases. But look, this was a promise which was made, way back in 2001, 2002. But somebody blocked that, and that's really up to them to say it. But this is where we are now, and I'll take nothing away from the Finucane family, but I want to argue for those others who are not getting anything from this whatsoever.
Doug Beattie, Sean Woodward, thank you for your time on The Nolan Show this morning. A little bit late for news, I'm afraid. We'll take your calls after the headlines. It's 9:38. Good morning. It's Holly here with you until 10:30. We are talking about the decision by the government to grant a public inquiry into the murder of Belfast solicitor Pat Finucane. Some unionist leaders describing it as favouritism, essentially, saying it's creating a hierarchy of victims. Let's speak to Michael, who's on the line. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Holly.
What do you make of this decision?
Well, I've been listening to the programme from the start this morning, and including the news clip in respect to John Finucane and what he talked about in terms of hierarchy or preferential treatment. The hypocrisy is unbelievable. Not everyone, there's over, as has been spoken about, over 1,000 other victims are looking for a judicial, or sorry, a public inquiry into the death of their loved ones. The difference between those and Pat Finucane's murder is that not everyone has the financial clout, the political clout, the legal clout that Sinn Féin has and that Pat Finucane has. They have the mechanisms of a powerful political party. They have the mechanisms of a massively rich party. They have the political, or sorry, they have the legal support of the machine of Sinn Féin. And not everybody has that. So to say that there's no that he, as in his words, he looks at it from he looks at it as a poor reflection. The fact of the matter is that not everyone has that, and that's why we are where we are. That's why the Finucane family have got where they are. They haven't got it on their own, in the sense they have this mechanism, this powerful support behind them, that the ordinary person doesn't have. So, I mean, that's my first point. My second point
I suppose just to that, then it's hard to criticise then, isn't it? Because if it was your father, your family member, and you had the wherewithal, the bottom line is murder, and this is a family who wants justice.
Yeah. But yes, murder is murder. But if there's an old saying, and it's very true. It's not what you know, it's who you know that plays a part in a lot of things. And the mechanism bit that Sinn Féin has, that the Finucane family have behind them, has got them where they are. They refused a public inquiry back in thing in 2005, and they then, due to what they had behind them, were able to go on and on and on and on. I don't know if someone has said that it's cost something in the region of £20 million.
I couldn't stand it. I don't have the figures in front of me. But it's been a long fight, though, Michael, hasn't it?
But they wouldn't have been able to do it. And this is my whole point. My whole point is, if the people, the other victims, have this mechanism behind them, maybe they would have got as far as...
Is it important to you how if they do get justice, is it important how or why or what the means are?
Providing everyone gets justice. If everyone has the same mechanism, absolutely, justice is vital in a democratic society. But they having the ability to get the justice is unfortunately around finance, political clout, who you know, etc., etc., and not everyone has that. It's not a level playing field when it comes to seeking a public inquiry.
Yeah, Michael, which probably explains why this process has gone on for as long as it has. Michael, thank you very much for your call. 03030 80 55 55. It is 9:43. Now, you can't miss this. We've got a new transport hub in Belfast. Very exciting. Grand Central Station. Not that one. It opened to the public on Sunday. The station cost £340 million. And Translink has estimated the new station will cater for up to 20 million journeys a year. So at the minute, I think it's only buses that currently operate at the station. Yeah, and trains will be starting in the next few weeks. But there have been a few concerns already raised by some passengers with mobility issues. Let's speak to Tim Hedgley, travel writer and disability campaigner, who got in touch with us about this. Morning, Tim.
Good morning, Holly.
So what have you made of this so far? What are some of the issues that you've found?
Well, there are a number of issues. For example, the fact that the station is a silent station, which basically means that anybody with visual impairments that can't see the notice boards to find out where to get their bus, then there is simply no assistance for them. And if you could imagine somebody, you know, if you picture somebody walking in to Grand Central Station with a guide dog, and they need to get a bus, and they can't see the screens, what are they meant to do?
What is normally in place in an establishment like this?
Well, normally you would have audio announcements of where to get a bus or where to get a train.
Oh, I see.
Now,
yeah.
there's a simple solution that, you know, Translink could have developed an app that goes on to a person's phone as soon as they come into the confines of the railway station. The station would know a blind person has come in or somebody with visual impairment, and the person with visual impairment would be able to listen to their phone and hopefully listen to which departure point. That's just on the visual side of things. From the practical, physical side of things, the changing places toilet doesn't appear to be fit for purpose. It's meant to have a sink that raises and lowers, so people in wheelchairs and people who are standing at the sink can use it. That doesn't seem to be in place, and I'm surprised that the station has opened without that being there.
Have you heard of Navilens? So Navilens is a tool that they have introduced, apparently, an innovative wayfinding tool supported by the RNIB, available to all customers. It uses mounted codes that, when scanned, it will relay assistive information via a user's device. Would that be effective?
Well, it would potentially help. Yeah, so Navilens is an app that you put on your phone, but that would potentially help for those with sight impairments.
Uh-huh.
But one of the big issues is that anybody who's physically prevented from getting into the bus station with the likes of electronic wheelchairs, the problem is they can't even get into the place because there is nowhere to stop outside the bus station to get out of your vehicle. There's no disabled parking at all. Now, it's in the pipeline, but the problem is if there's no disabled parking, somebody in a powered wheelchair cannot get out of their vehicle into their powered wheelchair and access the station because there simply is nowhere to park.
That's interesting.
And that's massive.
So if you say that something that is in the pipeline, they've said dedicated locations will be provided, allowing passengers to be dropped off and picked up easily. There will also be dedicated taxi pickup and drop off points. A car park will be opening as part of phase two, including accessible parking bays with electric vehicles and all the rest of it, and other accessible features opening as part of phase two. That includes an assistance dog spending area and parking for people with accessible and non-standard cycles. What do you make of that being part of phase two?
Well, it should have been part of phase one. Everybody in this community in Northern Ireland should be allowed to access the bus station. Why is it those with physical disabilities and visual disabilities are being put back to phase two? So, you know, if, for example, somebody in a powered wheelchair gets or wants to be dropped off at the bus station, they can't get there. But why are the able-bodied allowed to access the station and the disabled community being put to the back of phase two?
Is that how you feel?
Well, it's not just how I feel. I was speaking to a group yesterday on Zoom. We meet with lots of disabled people online, and they're all of the same opinion. Why can they not access the railway station at this time? Why should they have to wait to phase two? And it's almost like that the disabled community are being told, look, hold on a minute, you'll eventually get there, but we've got to let the walking people in first. There should not be that delineation of opportunity. Disabled people wish to access activities and services and goods, and the law, in fact, legislates that there can be no secondary allowance for the disabled. You know, the provision of goods and services under the Equality Act is for everybody. But at the minute, a lot of disabled people are being prevented from accessing the bus station. And that's reprehensible.
Tim, stay there. We've also got Pat on the line. Pat, the taxi driver. Morning, Pat.
Morning, Holly.
You've had a few issues too, have you?
Yes, Tim's hit the nail on the head there. We have had one driver on Sunday actually brought, I'll say, a more mature lady around. He couldn't get stopped. He had to stop on the main road. People were beating the horn at him because he was holding the traffic up. Then he realised that the steps outside for the main entrance, that the lady was having difficulty. He had to park the car, just leave the car there, abandon it, and help the lady up the steps to get her into the bus station. But there's meant to be a public hire taxi rank. Now, our taxis, I don't know whether you're familiar with our taxis or not, mm-hmm. Our taxis are 100% wheelchair accessible. There's nowhere about that station where we could stop to offload a wheelchair because we would be offloading the people into the middle of the road with oncoming traffic. And, you know, Minister O'Dowd was talking to us last week and he was all health and safety. Surely this is a health and safety issue. Plus the fact anyone requiring a taxi have to walk from the bus station to the old bus station in Glengall Street. There's no facilities about that £340 million station. It seems as if they've rushed to get it opened, but the main things that they need to do, look after our disabled folk, our elderly folk, who do get taxis. And there are a lot of people who, from hotels, from Belfast City Centre, who get taxis to the bus station, but we can't drop them off, and we've nowhere to pick them up. So I'm asking you, Holly, what are we meant to do? How does this get solved? Do we wait the phase two and tell everyone you can't go to the bus station because it's unsafe for us to drop you off? There's lights outside, but they're not outside the door. They're offset. They're up the street. If somebody walks out, they're going to walk out in the middle of the road.
Yeah,
health and safety.
I'll read you, Pat, what TransLink have said on the subject of set down and pick up arrangements. Public realm works surrounding the new station are ongoing and will continue through 2025 to significantly upgrade the streets and enhance pedestrian safety, making it easier and more accessible for all during this time. Set down and pick up for passengers and patrons of the station will be at the following. So they've given a list of places where you can take your passengers. St Andrew's Square, with some directions of how to get from there. All sort of in the immediate area, but not directly outside, which I suppose doesn't address the issue, like your passenger who was physically not quite as able.
Not as agile as an able bodied person would be. But Holly, they haven't addressed, this is in the future. It's 2024, so they're saying they're going to have that done by 2025. So what are we meant to do with passengers who are going to that bus station?
Yeah, this is what they're saying, that you have to go to the St Andrew's Square.
There was a lady in my car the other day whenever I was speaking to one of the researchers. She'd come up from Downpatrick for an appointment in the city hospital. She doesn't know her way about Belfast. The bus put her out or dropped her off, should I say, in Linen Hall Street. The lady didn't know where she was. I stopped to see if she was okay, and she was in a tizzy. I go to City Hospital. I'm normally dropped in Glengall Street, but the bus driver tells me, we don't go to Glengall Street. Can you? I don't know my way to the city Hospital. Your researcher was on the phone while I was getting her in. And to get picked up, she couldn't go to Glengall Street. She had to make her way after she went to the cancer centre. She had to make her way to Adelaide Street to get the bus. You know, people aren't being told what's going on, and they seem to be changing things as they go along. But saying that these works will be done by 2025 and there'd be pick-up and drop-off points by then, Holly, doesn't really help the situation. We need it now, not in 2025. You know, if somebody comes around the R rank today, going to the bus station, and they're in a wheelchair, mm-hmm. I can't get them out in the middle of the road. It's unsafe. So they haven't took any of this into account. They've just got it opened. All the flags and the whistles, the minister up cutting the ribbon, let it go, and we'll work as we go along. Well, you know, anything will do for anybody. Maybe they don't want, you know, they just want people on buses who can walk. They don't really want the disabled people or people arriving in taxis or taxis going there to pick people up, because people do arrive in this city and get off the bus and don't know where they're going, so they get a taxi to wherever they're going, and that's the service that we provide.
Almost word for word what Tim was saying as well. Meg is on the line too. Meg Hoyt from Belfast Cycle Campaign. Morning, Meg.
Good morning.
Cyclists are having some problems too.
Yeah, so similar to your other guests on the show, cyclists arrived at Belfast Central Station to find that there was nowhere to lock your bike. Now, again, similar to previous guests, this is coming. We're assured that there will be a really great sort of a cycle parking place eventually in a sort of phased opening. But we were concerned that, you know, active travel wasn't at the heart of the plans, and that we feel there could have been some temporary cycle parking provided at a bare minimum.
Now, just to say what TransLink have said on cycling, they've said they have a clear focus on active travel. Belfast Grand Central Station will be a game changer, helping inspire and reimagine the city. Let me see. Bike. Right. As part of the phased opening of Belfast Grand Central Station, we will provide temporary cycle parking in coming weeks, firstly beside the Durham Street entrance, then adjacent to the Grosvenor Road entrance. When the entire project, including public realm space, is completed in late 2025, we will have a provision to park over 200 cycles. I suppose the question, Meg, is what do the cyclists do in the meantime?
Well, this is it. And there actually are very few railings or anywhere that you could try and lock a bike. Everything's very smooth and sort of round in the entry to the station. You know, when we wrote to the CEO, Chris Conway, we got a very rapid response, and they did say they were working on temporary cycle parking as a matter of urgency. So hopefully it won't be weeks. Hopefully we're looking at days here until we see something that is clear and accessible, because we really want active travel to be, like I said, at the heart of this. I mean, a future vision for transportation for Belfast should really be thinking about how people are getting to the station and should have active travel at the heart of that.
Yeah. Do you feel rather that they do have a clear focus on active travel?
I mean, I don't think you could say it's clear at the moment. We are hopeful to see, you know, the cycle parking issues solved in the coming weeks. But we're also really looking to see how well cycle lanes will connect to Central Station, because that's the really big piece. People need to be able to cycle safely to the station and then lock their bike and then continue on their journey.
Meg, thank you very much. 03030 80 55 55. Peter is on the line in Belfast. Morning, Peter.
Hey, good morning, Holly.
Have you had the chance to use it yet?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to discuss a few issues in relation to the bus station. To begin with, the cost. Now, the day-to-day running, because of the size of it, I'm sure that's well increased. For instance, the heating. How on earth are you going to heat a building that size and with doors constantly opening and closing? The cost of that, and the fact that we're talking about the environment and trying to cut down our footprint. And then in relation to the cost, okay, it was $340 million just revealed there. Well, is that total including the trains being established? Because I'm wondering now, will there be a further cost then introduced after the train service is up and running? A bit like, you know, some of the other things, we seem to hear these little bits and pieces dropped in along the way. For instance, even with Casement Park there, and the fact that they have a taxi that Declan Bogue introduced there, it was actually the Good Morning Ulster. He introduced the fact that there's a toxic waste dump there, and it's going to cost a further £32 million to dispose of. I mean, it's been communally brushed onto the carpet. So I'm wondering, will there be other issues involving the bus depot and that as well that will be gradually dropped in?
This is what happens in any new grand development like this, in terms of if you want to, I suppose, develop anything in life, really, it's going to cost hundreds of millions of pounds. Peter, thank you very much for your call. If you have had any further issues at Grand Central Station, I mean, it is early days, let's be honest, but let us know. 03030 80 55 55. Thank you very much to Pat the taxi driver and to Meg Hoyt from Belfast Cycle Campaign and to Tim Hedgley, travel writer and disability campaigner, who got in touch with us. As I say, please let us know if you have any further issues. Coming up, we are going to be talking about the two neighbours who live next door, but probably unbeknownst to them, have voted for two very different things when it comes to signage outside their house. Bit awkward, isn't it? And we'll also be talking about the prisoner early release programme in England and Wales. Should something like that be introduced here? That's all coming up after your BBC News headlines. It's just approaching 10 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to The Nolan Show with Holly Hamilton with you for the next 25 minutes. Lots to get through, including Northern Ireland's First and Deputy First Ministers off to London today to meet the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. So the ministers will be joined by the Finance Minister, Caoimhe Archibald, at that meeting, which will focus on the pressures currently facing Stormont's finances. Deputy First Minister Emma Little-Pengelly has said that our public services here need more money.
We are not going to the government with a begging, but we're going with plans, we're going with proposals in terms of the sustainability of our budget, in terms of looking at sensible decisions, the things that we need to do in Northern Ireland. But of course, in order to have that transformation, you need to invest.
Well, BBC Northern Ireland Business and Economics Editor John Campbell's on the line. Morning, John.
Hello, good morning, Holly.
Well, It's sort of hard to guess what they're going to be talking about. Money's going to come up, basically. What are they hoping to get out of today?
Yeah, I think the finance minister was pretty clear earlier this week. There's not going to be some new one-off package of the sort we have been used to in Northern Ireland coming down the tracks. So there will be some extra money coming via the UK government over the course of this year through the normal, what are known as Barnett consequentials. That means when there's extra spending allocated in England, then we get a share of that. And certainly the expectation is there will be some extra money flows from the budget and then through other sources later in the year. But there's not going to be like this, like a big blockbuster package. That is not on the agenda. I think what this conversation is more about today is the longer term shape of how public services in Northern Ireland are funded. This is what is known as the fiscal framework. So that refers to the overall range of powers that Stormont would have over things like borrowing, spending, and taxation. So some work has already happened on that. We know that before the election was called, the finance minister reached an agreement with the Treasury where effectively any money which is coming here from Westminster gets a 24% top-up to reflect levels of need in Northern Ireland. But one of the things the ministers will be speaking about today is to say that they think that top-up is not enough and that it needs to be a bit higher, maybe about 27%, which would be, you know, doesn't sound very much of a difference, but would be worth, you know, over the longer term, hundreds of millions of extra for public services. So they will be trying to make the case to the Chancellor about that. But that will require further work. It will need some sort of independent third party to crunch the numbers before a case can be made to the Treasury. And I think on the other side of the table, the Treasury officials and ministers will be saying, you've made certain commitments in the money which we gave you to get Stormont back. One of those commitments is you're going to run a balanced budget, so you're clear that you're doing that. And secondly, you've also committed to raising additional revenue locally. Where are you on that particular policy?
All those meetings with Chris Heaton-Harris, the former Secretary of State, feel a million years ago right now. And I suppose the First Minister and Deputy First Minister will be hoping this is a clean slate. But I imagine they will still be sent back to Belfast with a bit of homework to do.
Yeah, so the ministers will change at the Treasury, but many of the officials are the same. So you have officials who have been working with Northern Ireland officials around this issue of what financial powers Northern Ireland should have. So they are still in place. They are still giving advice to the minister. And that is one thing they certainly will want to see the evidence of is around revenue raising. And we spoke about this yesterday, that the finance minister has now given the clearest indication that rates are going to be changing and that probably better off households can expect to be spending or expect to be paying more. So I would expect that certainly the executive ministers, that they will be in a position now to maybe give some indication to the Treasury about what is happening in terms of revenue raising, because the target they were given on revenue raising is not particularly stretching, but there is still more work to be done on that. So that is something where they may be in a position to provide an update to the Treasury as part of this kind of broader negotiation. So I don't think we can expect fruits from this negotiation anytime soon. And certainly that was what the finance minister was suggesting earlier this week. And this may be something which only kind of gets resolved in the context of what is known as a comprehensive spending review. That's when the new government will lay out its financial plans for the rest of this parliament. So over the next 3 to 4 years, that won't happen until next year. And potentially at that point, with maybe some movement on how Northern Ireland's finances are affected.
What about, though, all this talk of this fiscal cliff edge we're hanging off, this financial black hole, the talk of overspending by departments? We haven't seen the evidence of how the books will be balanced.
Yeah, so in theory, there shouldn't be a cliff edge because there has been extra money coming in as a result of the deal to restore Stormont, which allowed ministers to basically solve all those pay disputes and end the strikes in the public sector. So that gives them a bit of breathing space. And then the finance minister has said she'd received assurances that there will be no cliff edge when that money goes. And, you know, potentially that is to do with these top-ups, which Stormont is now getting in its regular infusions of money from Westminster. So that is not the immediate issue. I think the immediate issue is just the pressure that public services are under in Northern Ireland this year. And again, the minister was making clear earlier this week that an exercise which she conducted during the summer shows that departments think they need about £750 million more than is currently available in order that they can deliver the public services that they want to deliver. And she said, well, we don't have that money. We're going to get some extra from Westminster during the course of the year, but ministers are still going to have to cut their cloth. So I think when you look at it in that perspective, the ability of ministers to actually improve public services very much in the course of this financial year is limited. And in fact, things on that basis might actually get worse because effectively the spending departments have been told, listen, we know what you say you need. We don't have that money. So the budget which you currently have, you're going to have to make that work. You cannot bust the budget again this year.
John Campbell, as always, thanks for your insight on that. I'm sure you'll keep us posted throughout the day. It is 11 minutes past 10. Ah, everybody needs good neighbours, don't they?
Neighbours, everybody needs good neighbours, with a little understanding. You
so
can find the
perfect. This is all about a street in Belfast, a street with just two houses on it, and it's getting a new Irish street sign. That's after one of the houses on the street voted in favour of it and the other house voted against it. A Belfast City Council committee agreed dual English and Irish language signs for Grangeville Drive off the Upper Lisburn Road. Nine other streets were agreed for dual English and Irish language signs at different parts of the city during the monthly meeting of the council's People and Communities Committee. Let's speak to SDLP councillor Carl White. Good morning.
Good morning.
And writer for the Belfast Telegraph, Malachy O'Doherty. Good morning, Malachy.
Good morning, Holly. Morning, Carl.
Morning.
So, Carl, it's interesting that we've got, I mean, I don't know how often that happens. There's only two houses on the one street. Are they reflective of our society as a whole?
I don't think so, Holly. I think since the introduction of the bilingual signage scheme, the uptake has been phenomenal right across the city. And I think it's unusual in any town or city to have a street with two houses on it. And, that's what happened. I think it's an interesting story. In fairness to the Belfast Telegraph, I can see why they've run it. But I don't think it represents the wider view or direction of travel when it comes to Irish language signage in the city, no.
Yeah, do you know what? It's interesting that we've created this narrative around these two households. We don't know anything about them. We don't know who they are. We don't know their political views. We don't know why they voted for or against, whether they really care that much. Malachy, what have you made of this?
Well, what it illustrates is that the weighting of a vote for signage is greater than the weighting of a vote against it, which tells you that the council wants the spread of dual language signage. And so why does the council want the spread of dual language signage? I think the whole idea of promoting dual language signage on a street-by-street basis is bizarre. I think it's ludicrous. I think it's ill thought out. I think it ignores the fact that we live in a city which is demarcated on sectarian lines by so many things. Peace walls, flags, murals, curbstone painting. The location of churches, the organisation of political parties. And I would have thought responsible government would be about reducing the marking of territory on community lines rather than promoting it in this way. So I think Carl is bananas. I think they've come up with something utterly ridiculous, utterly counterproductive in the efforts to reduce sectarianism in the city, and something that they will regret, and they should change their minds on very quickly. But quite clearly, this is a beautiful case because it illustrates exactly the point that the council wants this because it is weighting a vote for signage as much heavier, greater than a vote against it, and that's not democratic. But even the very fact of going street by street is ludicrous, and this adds to the sectarian demarcation of the city. Nonsense, absolute nonsense.
Yeah, Carl, is it problematic doing it street by street? Or will there be inevitable issues being raised here?
Holly, I think you have to challenge what you've just heard there. You know, first of all, I've been called bananas, which is a new level of insult for anyone to have to sit and listen to in a radio show.
I don't need to, because you're here to defend yourself. You must be yourself.
I'm sorry, but you know, I expect when I go on a BBC show that I don't be told that, you know, you...
Carl, set out why you're not bananas then.
No, but sorry, I don't think it's funny to use that language, describing some... That's pejorative language used to describe people who may have mental health problems. So I think Malachy's language is pretty inappropriate there. It's also, you know, the idea that we shouldn't do it street by street. Well, if we didn't do it street by street, I know that Malachy O'Dougherty would be one of the first on complaining that we didn't do it. What would the alternative be to be doing it street by street? It's important to take people's views on board. It's important to consult with individuals on the street and see what their views are. And I've said this point before, and I'll say it again. Irish language speakers are a minority. It's a minority language. So you cannot ask that single minority to assemble themselves as a majority to have their rights enforced. We wouldn't ask any other minority to only... We wouldn't, sorry, provide the rights to any other minority only in areas where they are a majority. And I think that's what... Well, Malachy knows this. He knows it, but he keeps making this point, or he's made this point before, about democracy and that somehow has been, denied. It's not being denied. The law is very clear in minority languages. It's clear at the UN. It's clear in the Council for Europe. It's clear in which the UK is still a member of. And this is not Irish language signage. This is bilingual signage, and it can be any other language with English. People can apply for those signs in Belfast, and they should if they're interested in it.
So, Carl, this is the reason this story has probably made waves in the way that it has, because it is reflective that the reasons, or the rules, rather, behind this, that you have to have 50%.
Yeah.
And, 15%.
No, 15, yeah.
Sorry, 15%. Yeah. So in this instance, where, as you say, I mean, it's 50-50, by very definition, because it's two. But what happens then when it's 50-50 is that it becomes a bilingual sign.
That's correct.
So this is why it's kind of this tiny little microcosm of what is happening everywhere. So if there are people who feel, you know, and it has changed now that if you don't vote, then that's not seen as a negative either. So, you know, is it then reflective of people?
I think it's reflective of the direction of travel in the city regarding Irish language speakers and those who want to see the language. I accept that for some people who have been fearful around the language in the past, that it may be something that jars slightly with individuals. I've said to people before, you know, there's nothing to fear with the Irish language. The so-called politicization of it has actually, that label has been used as a way to block it. And it baffles me at times why, when we are looking at the majority of place names in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, Holly, when you look at them and you read them, they are from Irish. They're not from any other language. I think it's about 90% of place names.
Mm-hmm.
Why people wouldn't want to just see them also written in Irish. You know, it's not the marking of territory. It's a celebration of identity, of our history, a very rich cultural and linguistic history that we have here. And it's something that I want to see more of. And I think most people actually... you know, I was in Templemore Leisure Centre last night swimming with my kids, and I thought, you know, what a great service the council have provided here. It's great to see people just getting on with their lives, enjoying things, not getting wound up about everything. And I think that's the way most people feel about these signs.
So what about that then, Malachy? The Irish language is celebratory. It's about history. It's only problematic if you make it so.
Well, it is. The Irish language, the problem with the Irish language is that essentially the Republican cause is identified with it. And that caused and has done from the very beginning of say, from the proclamation of 1916.
So that rules
and
it out for the whole of the country.
Well, what that led to was Unionist Protestants tending to withdraw their interest in the Irish language. Now, here's the thing that you'll understand, Holly, and Carl will understand if he doesn't mind being, I don't know what,
whether
if he takes offence at being identified with a banana, then that's fair enough. I accept that he's offended by that. I've been identified with worse myself. You know that if you want to buy a house in Belfast, and you will go and you will walk down the street that the house is in, and you will see what are the markers of that community that are on display. Are there murals? Are there flags? Are there painted curbstones? Is there an Irish language signage? Because that will, or is an Ulster Scots signage? And that will tell you something about the character of that place, and it will suggest you whether you are comfortable living there or not. That is how things work in this place. We may not like it that they work that way. I despise the fact that they work that way, but I acknowledge that they do work that way.
Unlike a lot of the things like flags and stuff that you mentioned there is a movement to change the Irish language. Do you concede everybody now?
Absolutely, there's a movement, and the faster it moves, the better. Right? I have the silver fania myself. I learned Irish at school. I went to the Gaeltacht as a child. I speak a little Irish in informal settings. That's fine. That's great. You know, I'm all for that. But currently the stage we're at the moment is that it is a marker of demarcation. And Carl can prioritise the identity, the Irish identity, over the ending of sectarian division in the city. I put my priority in the other case. I say the marking of sectarian division in the city is a greater evil than the neglect of the identification of some streets and some people as Gaelic.
Carl, what do you make of what Malachy has had to say there? And he reflects the views of some who feel that way about the Irish language, that it is divisive. Is there an argument then that this street signage that's been implemented in some places when people don't want it, has it been counterproductive?
This idea that you can only do Irish language signage and therefore not reduce sectarianism, you know, it's so typical of the dichotomy that we see in so much political debate here. Like, we're not capable of doing one thing, more than one thing at the same time. Whether Malachy likes it or not, the Irish language isn't sectarian, and it's being desectarianized if it ever was. There have always been church groups of all the main churches right through the Troubles who continue to speak Irish and kept that language alive. There are groups.
Yeah, the Irish flag isn't sectarian. The tricolour isn't sectarian.
There are groups of learners.
Jack isn't sectarian. You know, murals, the United Irishmen aren't sectarian, but they are identified with communities, or they are perceived as identified with communities.
Well, which is, you know, you're saying on the one hand that, Carl, you said me personally, I can't promote Irish signage and also promote the reduction of sectarianism. Well, yes, I can, and yes, I do. And yes,
I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Oh, don't misquote me. I'm saying that the promotion of Irish language signage is a choice of one over the other. It isn't saying it negates the other. It says it gives it a higher priority. You're giving it a higher priority.
No, I'm not giving it a higher priority. I'm giving it the priority that actually the law requires it to have. And it's easy, I suppose, to sit in, you know, on the sidelines.
What's your vision of the future Belfast, Carl? What's your vision of the future of Belfast? I mean, do you want a Gaelic Belfast, or do you want a civic, secular, non-divided city where community relations are improved?
Sorry to interrupt you, Carl.
Worded on the radio.
I'll appreciate, if you want to answer that question, fine. But what I want to ask you, Malachy, you know, you said earlier that you agree that there is a movement towards the Irish language. But then it's something you said, you sort of support that, but then you're saying now that you don't, that you don't want it to progress.
I think the work being done to promote the Irish language cross-community as something which isn't tied to a communal identity, a factional identity in Belfast, is a very good thing. I applaud that. I think it's a wonderful thing. But we're not there yet. And I don't think that creating division over this helps that. And what we are seeing in council is that all of the unionist parties are opposing this. So there's the evidence of the division if you're looking for one.
So then, yeah, it goes back to Carl then. If we're creating division with putting street signs in places where people perhaps don't want it, as they say on this street, 50% don't want it, then it's counterproductive then in what this movement is trying to achieve.
Well, Malachy's highlighting, he asked me an important question of what's my vision of Belfast. I want Belfast to be the best small city in Europe to live, work and visit. And it's common to see, if we're going to talk specifically about bilingual signage, and Belfast is a city where the identity largely isn't contested, Holly. So while people disagree about the north or north of Ireland, most Belfast people are proud of being from Belfast. They love Belfast. They like Belfast people. And that's who we are. Bilingual signage is common in other parts of the UK. So I don't. It's very. It's Wales is completely bilingual. Sets global is a global beacon of bilingualism. You've got more bilingualism in Scotland now than you've ever had. In many ways, what we're doing is better than some parts of the south in certain aspects, but especially around education and bilingual education. So that's what I want. Do I want? City
in bilingual cities like, say, Rennes in Brittany or like Dublin, you get the signage all over the whole city. You don't get areas where it's where it is and areas where it isn't. You can't walk around Dublin and say
bilingualism as well. Irish is not a I don't think Dublin is a particularly good example to look at if we're going to get into that. But I don't think that's what the show. I don't think that's what we're on. You asked me, Holly, about the 50-50 and the 15%. I accept that people. That is a challenging concept at the beginning. Well, if it's not a majority,
challenging concept.
Why do you get?
Go ahead. It's a lovely phrase. Yeah, nice to be it's a lovely euphemism. You know, for a total stitch up.
Without being constantly sniped at, actually, which is
right.
What this feels like.
Hang on, you two. Take a break. 2 seconds. We're going to hear stuff from someone.
I'm going to make my point, which I've already made in this show. 15% is because you cannot ask a group of people who are a minority to assemble themselves as a majority to have their rights enforced. And we don't ask any other minorities to do that. So whether they're Ulster Scots speakers, Irish speakers, whatever language, I'm not going to
Why
say...
Why are you called a right? What gives you a right to have
the law
your
gives you the
preferred
right
language or your native
the
law on the signage of your street? Where does this come from?
Well, you can UN Charter on Languages, Council for Europe. There's lots of regulations.
So the Polish people living in Belfast, for instance, would be entitled as Polish. They're legally entitled.
We've already had this discussion on the radio. Yeah, they would, and they should. Same with Ulster Scots. Same with Chinese. Any group of
there are 6 15s in every 100. There are 6 15% in every 100. So I mean, what if I have 30% of people in my street would roll? I actually asked the council. To see if we could have dual language French signage here in recognition of the way we were ditched out of the European Union. I didn't even get a reply.
Adrian in Belfast is listening to this. Adrian.
Yes, Holly, thanks.
Good morning.
I think this is morning. This is an absurd argument and an absurd position for the council to have taken. Malachy is absolutely spot on. We can't have it that in any form of democracy. If the electorate consists of two and they vote one way and the other, then you don't change things. It's a fundamental of how boards are operated, how government, how all sort of sensible decisions are made, that if there's no majority for the vote, then the status quo applies. And that's what happened here. And if the city council is in any form of financial difficulties, and one suspects it probably would say it needs more money, then the last thing it needs to do is to be spending council ratepayers' money on changing a sign that the majority of people don't want.
Adrian, thanks for your call. I'll take another call on this now. Marion. Good morning, Marion.
Bonjour, comment ça va?
Bonjour, magimoi.
Hey, j'espère que tout le monde comprend ce que je dis.
Ah, oh, très bien. Votre français,
right.
C'est très
you
bon.
You know, for flip's sake, you know.
What's French for flip's sake? I don't know.
They want to catch a grip, that council. Because, you know, I'm old enough and I'm all around the place and I own different stuff all around the place. And, you know, there is sectarianism. And we have to stop the divisiveness. Malachy is spot on. And he should not be ridiculed by, I don't know who Carl is. I'm just late in the conversation.
He is an SDLP councillor. He's called Carl
White. Is that
White.
What he is? Well, that figures then.
So do you see okay. The Irish language? Do you see the Irish language as something that does politicise people?
Yes, I do.
You do?
I absolutely do.
What would change your mind?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Zero, because, you know, I'm an old age pensioner, plus.
Oh, well,
and I've been round too many corners, and I see the division. I live near the peace line, and I will not even go there.
Well, Marion, really appreciate you getting in touch with us this morning. Thanks for all your calls. Just before we go, earlier in the programme, we were asked some questions about the Independent Commission for Reconciliation and Information Recovery's effectiveness, saying when we look at it, it's only 8 cases in its first 4 months. The ICRIR have been in touch to say up to the 31st of August, they have registered 85 requests from individuals who are currently being dealt with by the case support team. Of those 85 requests, 8 have now been accepted for investigation and are in the information recovery stage. Happy to clear that up. Have a good morning. Connor's next. Listen
again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show.